This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by Flare, a leader in providing actionable cyber threat intelligence to companies and governments around the world.
Today's guest on Intelligence Matters is Judge James Baker. Judge Baker is director of the Syracuse University Institute for Security Policy and Law, as well as a professor at the Syracuse College of Law and the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs. He also serves as a judge on the Data Protection Review Court. Judge Baker previously served as chief judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. As a career civil servant, he served as legal advisor and deputy legal advisor to the National Security Council. He has also served as counsel to the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board and Intelligence Oversight Board. In addition to teaching at Syracuse University, Judge Baker has taught at Yale, Iowa, Pittsburgh, Washington University, and Georgetown. He's the author of numerous articles and three books, one of which, The Centaur's Dilemma, National Security Law for the Coming AI Revolution, we will discuss today. We'll be right back with a discussion of national security law and the intersection of technology and national security with Judge Baker. But first, here's my colleague, Michael Morrell, with a message about Flare.
The lines between geopolitical risk and cyber risk are blurring. Flare is a next-generation, continuous threat exposure management SaaS platform that equips corporate information security teams with world-class collection and continuous monitoring across dark web cybercrime forums, markets, Telegram channels, and sources of geopolitical risk. Flare sets up in 30 minutes, creates actionable intelligence from hour one, and is used by governments, security teams, and threat intelligence teams around the world. You can try Flare's free trial at their website, flare.io. That's flare.io.
Welcome back. Judge Baker, Jamie, great to talk with you.
Thank you, Andy.
Thanks so much for joining us on Intelligence Matters. You know, why don't we start out a little bit by you telling our listeners about yourself and, you know, how you got into, you know, the national security law field, a little bit of your background.
Oh, thank you, Andy. I'm happy to do so. The short answer about my professional career is that I've spent 40 years in the government and 20 years as an academic. I never intended to become a lawyer or a national security lawyer. I joined the Marine Corps as an infantry officer out of college. And I was actually planning to be a career infantry officer until one day while I was serving as an aide-de-camp to a general, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan called up. And he announced on the phone that I would start working for him the next week. And I explained to Senator Moynihan, for whom I'd been an intern the previous, during summer, during college, I said, I'm in the Marine Corps. And he said, I know you're in the Marine Corps. You start next week. And I said, doesn't work like that. You can't just leave. And he said, oh, yes, you can. I've worked it out with the Commandant of the Marine Corps. And you'll come work for me. And if there's a war, I will send you back. So that's how I ended up in Washington the first time with no intention of becoming a lawyer. And I stayed in the Marine Corps Reserves. Until one day, Senator Moynihan called me in his office and he said, you're apolitical, aren't you? And I thought this was a great compliment because he was suggesting that I was nonpartisan. And I think he was more suggesting that I was the first person he'd ever met who wasn't political. and he said, well, you're going to work for the government all of your life, so you have to go to law school. And I said, I don't want to go to law school. Who would want to be a lawyer? Which is what I in fact said. And he said, oh, I don't want you to go to law school to become a lawyer. I want you to go to law school so if anybody in the government ever asks you to do something immoral or unethical or unlawful, you can tell them to take a hike and you will have a profession to fall back on. That's not actually what he said I should say, but I can't say what he said on a podcast. So that's how I ended up at law school. How I ended up as a national security lawyer, well, I still had the bug of service in me from the Marine Corps, of course. And I went to law school. Fortunately, I went to a law school without grades. And I said to myself, the year was 1987, and I said to myself, what do I need to know to serve my country? And I thought the two issues that are going to dominate my generation are terrorism and environmental degradation. So that's when I chose the fork of national security law, and I ended up doing everything I could to prepare myself to become a national security lawyer at that time. I like it. I stuck with it for the simple reason. I think my answer to Senator Moynihan was the correct one. Who would want to be a lawyer? But if you word it a different way and say, who would want as their mission the duty to support and defend the Constitution, that's a pretty awesome mission. That's something that has inspired me every day I've come to work ever since I went to law school, the opportunity to have as my job each day supporting and defending the Constitution.
So, you know, Jamie, in the introduction, I mentioned that you were Chief Justice on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. And foolishly, I'd never heard of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces until I read your background. So maybe you could just tell us a little bit about what it is, what it does.
Sure. Well, first of all, it's probably a good thing that you hadn't heard of it, especially if you have served in the military. I always look and make sure I haven't seen someone's name before, because that usually means I've seen their name in the context of United States v. but the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is the federal civilian appellate court that hears military justice appeals from the military justice system. And it is purposefully a civilian court. It's one mechanism to provide civilian oversight of the military. And in the military justice system, the trial is known as a court-martial. And in the American system of justice, whether you're in a state court, a federal court, or in a military court, you always have a right of appeal. And the right of appeal in the military justice system is to a service court of appeals, the Army Court of Criminal Appeals, the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. And from each of those courts, either the appellant, who's now been convicted and is appealing, the appellant or the government can appeal to our court, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. And we're providing, in theory, and I would say in practice, we're providing the uniform part of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, providing, making sure that the same Fourth Amendment principle is the same principle that applies in the Marine Corps, as applies in the Air Force, as applies in the Navy. And jurisdiction for the military justice system is based on service status. That's an important thing, because it means that if you're in the military, on or off duty, anywhere in the world, you are subject to the military Uniform Code of Military Justice. That means you're also subject to U.S. criminal law, because the Uniform Code of Military Justice incorporates federal law, Title 18, and incorporates state law. And so if you are in a barroom fight off base in North Carolina, you are also subject to the military justice system, as well as the law of the state of North Carolina, for example. And so most of the cases that come before this court are criminal. Well, they're all criminal law cases, but they're all common law criminal law cases, murder, rape, and so on, and as well as some statutory offenses, I'm sorry to report, such as possession of child pornography. But they're ordinary criminal offenses for which you would see in a state court. And then there are military-specific or national security-related cases. And the ones your audience have probably heard of are cases involving Abu Ghraib or the Fort Hood shooter, or a case arising in Afghanistan or Iraq involving either detainees or something that occurred on the battlefield. But the majority of the cases are criminal law cases. That means the majority of cases are cases involving rules of evidence, cases involving criminal procedure, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, and First Amendment cases, the same sorts of criminal law questions that occur in courts throughout the United States, whether those courts are federal, state, or in our case, a product of the military justice system.
You're sort of the last step in that process?
So, fair question. Good question. Yes and no. No in the sense that the Supreme Court is the last stop. It has jurisdiction over most but not all of the cases that come to our court for complicated reasons that probably are not worth explaining here, very important to the parties, but probably less important in the nature of a podcast. But that has to that's based on the nature of the jurisdiction that Congress has created for this court. So as a practical matter, we are often the court of last resort, but appeal can be taken to the Supreme Court. During my 15 years on the court, only one case was taken by the Supreme Court and heard by them. Another case was incorporated as a trailer, meaning the Supreme Court decided a different lead case, but our case fell within the outcome of that case, known as a trailer. But so they didn't take a lot of cases, right? One in my 15 years. It's likely that they invariably take death penalty cases from that come up through the military justice system. And in the case that they took during my 15 years had to do with question of jurisdiction and the applicability of a writ called Coram Nobis. And I think the interest to the Supreme Court was the nature of the writ, which dates back to the All Writs Act of 1798, and so on. But the point is, they could take a case, and often appellants will appeal to the Supreme Court if they are not satisfied with the legal outcome at our court. But they don't take many cases.
So, Jamie, let's talk a little more about about national security laws, which is what you spend most of your career doing, and in your book, recent book, The Centaur's Dilemma, which we'll talk more about in a little bit, you say that national security law has three purposes. Number one, the authority to act and the boundaries of that action. Number two, creating a process. And number three, retaining values. With those in mind, can you just sort of tell our audience, how national security law works, who creates it, what are its limitations, what's its purpose, just to make sure we've got everyone sort of on the same page?
Thank you, Andy. Thank you first for deriving that from the book. I used to have a rule that I'd have one of my wonderful clerks serve as what I call the cold clerk, and they would not participate in the dialogue about a case. And then I'd write an opinion, and I'd think I had written the world's greatest opinion, and I'd give it to the cold clerk to read and see what they extracted from the opinion. And if I thought I wrote a great case about the Fourth Amendment, or a great opinion about the Fourth Amendment, and the clerk came back and said, well, really interesting discussion of the Fifth Amendment, I would know that I hadn't done such a great job articulating what I thought I was articulating. So I'm glad you got that message out of the book. Thank you for that. First, let's start with a definition of national security law. I have a rather long and elaborate definition that I've provided in a guide I wrote to national security law. So if you'll allow me, I'll read it and then I'll elaborate on what I'm saying. National security law is the substance, process, values, and practice of law relevant to national security decision-making. It includes constitutional law, statutory law, executive directive, international law, and foreign law. Another way to look at it is it includes what we call national security law, homeland security law, private national security law, and general counsel law. All of those things, all in one. But the common denominator is it relates in some manner to national security decision making and or the running and operation of national security departments and agencies. So who practices national security law? Mainly, this is going to come as a real shock to both you and your audience, national security lawyers do. But where are they? They're at the agencies, right? They're in the general counsel offices of agencies. They're at the in the military serving as judge advocates. They're civilians serving at the Department of Defense. They are serving in the Office of General Counsel at the CIA and so on. What I would say to the audience is, a lot more people practice national security law than we probably assume. Lawyers at the Treasury Department, lawyers throughout different government agencies will have some component of national security practice as well. A couple of key points here, though. One, a lot of national security law is practiced in secret. Necessarily so, because you're dealing with classified matters. And in many cases, unlike, say, the criminal law or civil law, the issues do not ultimately get resolved in a court setting, and they're not subject to external commentary from academics and others. That means national security lawyers, sometimes very junior lawyers, often are the only persons who are addressing the legal issues presented by national security issues and decisions. That's a very important role and very important for them to remember. Their ultimate duty is to support and defend the Constitution, not please the client, but support and defend the Constitution.
So, you know, Jamie, something you said there triggered a thought, and the fact that clearly it's secret, right? Does that put a finer point on this balance between national security and individual liberties? Since not everyone can sort of see the way the machine is working, so to speak, right? That they could in a more public venue.
So, a couple responses to that. First, I'm usually hesitant. Most people will say balance between national security and individual liberties. And certainly, supporting and defending the Constitution encompasses both providing for the physical security of the United States and preserving and protecting its values, including its liberty values. But I would say that balance is not always what we should be looking for. If you're flying at 35,000 feet, you're not looking for balance between the security screening process and the civil liberties of the people going through the security screening process. So it's contextual, right? If the issue is the right to a jury trial, we're not balancing the national security interest in having a secret trial. No, the right is absolute. So one has to say, is this a situation where we should be balancing, or is this a situation where there's a tension, and how should we resolve that tension? In my view, many of those issues are contextual issues, and they have to do with analyzing the particular problems. I think I might have lost the trail of your question, and that's on me, but. Because we are dealing sometimes, not always, sometimes with issues of individual rights and liberties and not just physical security and traditional national security concepts, the duty of the national security lawyer is to objectively assess the law. In the book you cited, I go through and I talk about the different roles that lawyers play. And whether they should play the role of the advocate or the role of the judge. And in my view, national security lawyers should play all those roles. The question is when. So when you're advising the president, in my case, or you're advising the director, perhaps in your case, or an OGC lawyer's case, you should play the role of telling the client. I always viewed the client as the Constitution, but here we're talking about the person you're advising, telling them what the law is, not telling them what they wish the law would be, but calling it straight. And a lot of national security law is unsettled. That's because it derives from the Constitution. That's because a lot of the issues that come up may not be foreseen. And many of the laws are procedural laws, not substantive laws. The National Security Act provisions that relate to covert action, for example, are largely procedural in nature. They tell you what has to be done, not necessarily what the correct outcome is. So that means that a lot of questions that lawyers face in this area are not yes or no questions. There are, on the one hand, blah, 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 the argument is this. On the other hand, the argument is this. In my view, the better view is this or that, or this is a legally available argument, or it is not. So I think it's very important for national security lawyers to advise those they're advising on the strength of the argument, not just on its existence. As I like to say, it's easy to get to yes in national security law. The key is to get to yes with honor, to solve the problem, but do so with honor. Leon Firth, a wonderful national security advisor to a former vice president, described the duty of the national security lawyer as getting to yes with honor, with the nation well taken care of and the Constitution intact. That's no easy thing given the pressures that national security lawyers face, because we're dealing with hard problems and time constraints.
So, Jamie, now that we've talked a bit about national security law and what it is, I think it's an opportune time to sort of talk about your book here, Centaur's Dilemma, which is about national security law and AI, a big issue facing all of us. A clear reference here to Greek mythology and a half-man, half-horse creature. So I have to ask, you know, why did you use that reference and what's the dilemma?
Sure. Thank you. Well, the reference comes from the Department of Defense term. They refer when I started researching AI in 2017, the Department of Defense referred to its AI work as a Centaur model. But of course, they weren't talking about horses and humans. They were talking about part man, part machine, or part human, part machine. So that was the Centaur. And the dilemma, there's a number of dilemmas with artificial intelligence, but the core dilemma in the Centaur's dilemma is how much human and how much machine in each context. And the more human control you assert or insist upon asserting, sometimes the less benefit you get from the capacity of the machine to act autonomously and instantaneously. If you're thinking about AI tools in cyberspace, for example, that might be used for offense or defense, if you insert the human to exercise control at the moment the adversary is advancing the attack, the AI is not going to be able to respond instantaneously, and you'll lose the benefit in the capacity of the AI, or at least part of it. So that's a dilemma. On the other hand, there's almost no model of AI use that we don't ask ourselves or insist upon appropriate human control. So the dilemma is, where do you assert that control? Do you assert that control in the software? Do you assert that control by not developing the thing in the first instance because it doesn't make sense? Where do you assert the human control? And where do you let the machine operate with the full capacity of the machine to analyze data, augment data, analyze it, apply it, and respond?
So in your book, you make an argument that some form of legislative regulation of AI is required, you know, in the national security framework. Now, of course, you can almost hear people in the audience lining up on one side of that argument or the other, as a lot of people do. But can you elaborate a little bit on why you think legislation is the way to solve some of those challenges that you see arising?
Sure. Well, so when I say legislation, regulation, I'm talking about law writ large, And I'm talking about perhaps statute, perhaps the always constitutional law, of course, but also directive, executive directive, and so on. And the one reason I favor a regulatory outcome, perhaps in the form of legislation, or is because I don't think Microsoft and Meta and Google should make national security policy in the area of AI or perhaps any other area, any more than I think the Department of Defense should define our national security law or our artificial intelligence policy for the United States. We need a constitutive process, such as the legislative process, to contend with the competing values and tensions that arise. Does it need to be a statutory process? Not necessarily. The President of the United States on October 30th issued a fairly comprehensive, not a completely comprehensive, but a comprehensive executive order on AI, which of course we can talk about. It has some strengths and it has some weaknesses. But I do favor a regulatory regime. And here's partly why I favor it. There are three buckets of legal, of ethical issues, some of them legal and some of them ethical, when we deal with AI. In my view, those three buckets are what we've just talked about, the Centaur's Dilemma box, which deals with human-machine augmentation and teaming. When do you do, how do you do that, and how do you do that in context? The next box is the box of bias, with artificial intelligence. As much of our audience will now know, artificial intelligence comes with many different types of bias, bias in the data that's used to train it, test it, and validate it, by human bias in the programming, perhaps. And there's a list of about 10 different types of bias that enter into artificial intelligence design and operation, which I go through in the book. And people more expert than me go into greater detail in elsewhere. And then the third box is data, right? Artificial intelligence thrives on data. We know that many different companies scrape data. The U.S. government sometimes buys data. And the president signed an executive order trying to limit or authorizing the attorney general to limit certain data that is going overseas and is being bought by foreign governments and other actors, think China. Ethics and law can help regulate and control these three boxes. And my message, as it is in national security more generally, this is an area where law, ethics, and lawyers can lead to a better result, because the more accurate, the more you address things like bias, the more you address the provenance and the quality of the data, and the more you analyze the Centaur's Dilemma, the more accurate and effective your artificial intelligence system is going to be. That's something national security operators should want.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with Judge Baker.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
Do you worry at all that this could put us at a bit of a disadvantage? Because, you know, regulation is fine, but sometimes, you know, we've seen that, you know, it can be overdone.
Sure.
And
sure.
Of course, the argument, you know, the argument some people will make is if you overregulate, you squelch innovation and so on and so forth. Right.
Yeah.
So it's keeping those two opposing forces in mind.
So that is a fair point, and you may agree with this or disagree with this, or view it as a cop out or not. So when I talk about process, right, the second purpose of law is process. What I mean is good process. Lawyers are great at giving you process, but we don't want process. We want good process, something that is effective and leads to a better security result. And so when I talk about regulation of AI, I'm sure some in the audience will think of layers of regulation, and no doubt they're also thinking of the EU's Artificial Intelligence Act, which is about to go final, which is very heavy on regulation. And one of the debates about the AI Act in Europe is, will it stifle innovation? And that's a very legitimate question. And I think the drafters of the EU AI Act will say, well, that's why we exempted research and development from the requirements of the Act. The key, in my view, is to make wise decisions. And I always favor procedural. I favor procedural rules and regulations as opposed to substantive ones that say you can't do something. Why is that? Because especially with technology that is moving exponentially like AI, we don't want to end up with the Communications Act in 1934 and try to apply it to current technology. It doesn't work. And so what I would favor in this area is procedural requirements that require a human to make a purposeful and accountable decision at critical stages. A procedural law that would designate an accountable party that is responsible for what the AI system does or does not do. And as you know, in government, as elsewhere, when you know you're the accountable party, you take an interest in something and make sure it works. When we don't know who the accountable party is, that's somebody else's problem. I hope it works. And so I very much favor procedural laws. We know this, for example, in something like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act or the Covert Action Statute. When you require something to be reviewed by the Attorney General, or you require something to be signed by the President of the United States, all of a sudden people start paying attention in a way they weren't before. You may not like the outcome in any event, but you're going to get a more rigorous process of review. So that's a part. But can I make one more point? Because I think this is very important. We can compare ourselves and say, oh, law and regulation and ethics may impede innovation. And we might say, well, here we have a comparison between the EU and the United States, which has so far used the executive order model. But we should also compare ourselves to authoritarian regimes, China and Russia, which, of course, use AI, China to monitor its population, and both of them to spread disinformation and falsehoods. And my response is, well, sure, they have the advantage of not having law and not having ethics and being able to coordinate in the way an authoritarian society can do so. But where does AI talent want to work? Is it running off to China so that it can work on unethical AI to surveil the population? Or is it going to come to the United States where it can serve a greater good? And what we've seen so far is talent's coming to democracy. Talent wants to work on ethical AI, not authoritarian AI. And part of being ethical AI is having principles and law that applies to what you do with the AI and how you use it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. In your book, you sort of say that we need to have a process set for machine speed, which I thought was an interesting phrase. Do you think legal professionals are trained to navigate this landscape? I mean, sometimes, you know, the way I think about it is like we've got a huge racetrack and the law is on the outer rim of that racetrack, moving at a certain speed. Technology's on the inside track, moving at a much faster speed. Can we hope for those two things to actually mesh together? Or is the law always just going to be lagging?
Wow. Yes. Yes is the answer. So I like to say case law never keeps up with Moore's law.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And nor should we expect it to, right? One is exponential, the other is linear, and always will be. So that's, again, why I favor thinking about good process and putting process in law so it actually happens, where we actually know who's accountable, where we expect certain things to occur before an AI system is deployed, and we expect certain things to occur after it's deployed. Like validating that it's actually doing what you intended it to do and doing it accurately or within the variance that was expected. While case law doesn't keep up with Moore's law, lawyers do, right? Lawyers are going to apply the law they have. We saw that today with the president's executive order using the International Economic Emergency Powers Act to regulate the flow of data. And so lawyers are always on the hook and always responsible for applying the law that they have. And guess what they always have? They always have the Constitution, and they have internal directives. So to your point, do I think the law can keep up? No. Do I think lawyers can? Yes. They must. They must. And they're going to use the tools they've always used, which is their ability to analyze issues, to take complex ideas and translate them into plain language that other people can understand. And let me say, I'm living proof that it can be done. When I started studying AI, after being tricked into doing so by Jason Matheny, the wonderful former director of IARPA and now the president of RAND, when he tricked me into studying AI, I say I could not spell AI. And our job as lawyers is not to be the coder. It's not to be the technical expert. It's to understand the technology well enough to understand where are the moments and places where key decisions should be made in the development, research, and so on, and make sure we are in the room where those decisions are being made, so we can influence the outcome in a positive way. And that is something lawyers have always done. And they've always had new challenges, right? National security lawyers should be particularly good at it, because one of the things a national security lawyer has to do is figure out how to get into the room, how to get into the room that is smaller and smaller and smaller because it's more secret and more secret and more secret. And so national security lawyers should be particularly good at figuring out where they should be and when it comes to AI. And the answer is a very different answer than they're used to. They have to get upstream to the point of conceptual development and design, and they have to get downstream, not just at the point of deployment and decision, but further downstream at the point of assessment and validation, to make sure the system is working as intended within the boundaries of law and ethics. So it's a fun task, but it's one that national security lawyers are up to.
So Jamie, let's just ask a question here, because you know, one of the groups that listens to this podcast are students, both undergraduate and graduate students, maybe some of your students at Syracuse. Many of them are aspiring to some kind of a national, you know, security career or some type of public service. So what would you say to them? What advice would you give them as we enter sort of a very different kind of environment than maybe the ones that you and I entered on when we, you know, started this kind of work in the 80s?
Thank you for saying I started in the 80s. I started in the 70s. But oh well, that's how it goes. Every generation thinks it's facing the greatest number of challenges in the national security area that any generation's ever faced. And my response to that is, tell that to the Civil War generation or the World War II generation and so on. Or I think of General Marshall, George Marshall, who fought in World War I, was the architect of victory in World War II, and then was Secretary of State and Defense during the Cold War. And when he was confronted with a new crisis and people were running around with their head, you know, the hair on fire, he would say, I've seen worse, right? He could put things in perspective. In my 40 years dealing with national security, I have not seen a more complex set of challenges than that challenge set that we have today. And one of the set of challenges comes from emerging technologies like AI, synthetic biology, genetic engineering, and quantum information systems. Those are new. So my advice comes now as follows. First, we all need to be lifelong learners. We don't come to the table with what we know. We come to the table with what we're learning. And we need to be constantly learning. And that's a challenge, but it's an important one. So if I'm running an agency general counsel's office, I'm figuring out new ways to keep people current and new ways to integrate technologists, policy people, operators, and lawyers, because this requires a new kind of teaming and a new kind of knowledge. But here's my more basic advice, which I think applies across time and generations, especially to younger lawyers and to students. Make the most of whatever opportunity you're given, even if it's not the opportunity you were looking for. And this is advice we've all received. This is the advice that my the general I was an aide to would say. He was the fat rendering officer, and you don't want to know what a fat rendering officer is, but that's the officer who measures the amount of fat in the meat that's given to the mess hall. And it's not a career enhancing position. It's a messy, smelly position. And he said, when you're the fat rendering officer, be the best fat rendering officer you can be. And so my advice is figure out what it is about be as good at the job you're in as you can possibly be, which ties to the next one, which is find the pony and ride it. And that's a reference to a phrase that President Reagan liked to say, which is, you know, that you walk into a room and there's a lot of horse manure in there. And the kid says, there must be a pony in here somewhere, right? And in every job, there's a pony. And lawyers, among others, know that lots of jobs have elements to them that are pretty boring and can be repetitive and onerous and all that. But with every job, including every legal job, there's a pony in there somewhere. So go find the pony. Don't sit around and talk about how bad it smells. Go find the pony and ride it. Couple more. More senior does not necessarily mean most impactful. And figure out what you really value about your job. And there are people, and I'm sure you've met them, Andy, as well as I have, who are very ambitious, and they seem to find their way to Washington. And they might measure their self-worth based on the seniority of the position. But one of the great pleasures about working with people in your former building and at the State Department and at DOD is you're also around a lot of people who just want to serve a greater good. And it turns out, at least for me, serving a greater good was more rewarding than finding my way into a senior position. So think about that. I would say to students, it's very important to have mentors, but not just mentors, but mentors who are advocates, mentors who will go to bat for you. Last two, double down on what you can control. So we can sit around here and complain about, I never get picked to do this. I never get to do that. The one thing you can always control is your own character. You can control your own integrity, and you can control how hard you work. And indeed, whether you're doing the lifelong learning we all need to do as lawyers. So focus on that. Don't focus on the things you can't control on. Focus the things you can and double down on those. And then finally, this is something every Marine lieutenant learns. It's not the only place you learn it. But every Marine lieutenant learns that we're all dispensable, right? No one's indispensable. And that's a great lesson to learn. And it's great when you learn it as a young second lieutenant. But there is one job for which any of us is indispensable, And I like to remind myself of this too, which is the only job for which I've ever been indispensable is that of being a parent. For only I can be a parent to my own children. And so keep that in mind as you go along. What are the things that you alone can do and are indispensable for? And that will help set a lot of, give you a sense of perspective some of us benefit from.
Fantastic. Jamie, thank you for a really thoughtful and great discussion.
Thank you, Andy. My pleasure.
That was Judge James E. Baker. I'm Andy McCreadis. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters. And you can always reach us at intelligencematterspod@gmail.com.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.